Well, can we agree at the outset that this is a decidedly difficult gospel text appointed for today? I look back in 21 years of preaching, I've never preached on this gospel text for some reason. It wasn't by intent. But I thought, well, maybe I could angle in with that one phrase about God knows the hairs on your head, but that would be a short sermon for me. So maybe we can come in from a different way and divide it into two sections. The first part, I'll just touch briefly, that Jesus is telling his followers, you will surely be persecuted if you follow me, if you espouse this way of life, and even your family members may turn on you. But remain steady, keep the faith, trust in God. But where I really want to focus is this second part of the text. It just stops us short, right? With talk of a sword to cleave us from our family members. And it's helpful to know that it's prophetic language in that section. It's referent back to the prophet Micah and back to a time when the Israelites turned on one another and literally families were being torn apart. Now, Matthew's gospel, for all of its glory and beauty, can be a bit hyperbolic in its rhetorical style. So we get some of that here, but perhaps we can still angle in as we seek our understanding and inspiration in our lives today. So what is it that Jesus is saying to you and me here and now? And for that, I want to use a modern-day parable, a film, actually, that some of you may have seen this year, a work of fiction that speaks its truth alongside the realities of life. I first watched the film The Banshees of Inisherin this past spring when it was abuzz in all of the awards season. And while I found the film quaint and quirky and witty and raw and exquisitely beautiful, I didn't get it. I did not get the meaning of the movie. So a little bit about the movie if you've not seen it. Set in 1923 on a remote island off the west coast of Ireland, we watch as two longtime friends, Porrig and Colm, destroy their bonds of brotherly affection for one another for the most inane of reasons. On not much more than a whim, they jettison their friendship, their camaraderie, and they turn self-destructive and mutually destructive. It's Porrig's sister. She's the only sensible one in the whole movie who sees the fight between Porrig and Colm for what it is. It's tragic violence with no redeeming value. Now, I'm going to stop there and sharing the details of the movie because I think it's a movie worth watching. If you've not seen it, go try it on. I will tell you that Kathy and I watched it again last week as we made our way back from Ireland to home. We had spent time on the island of Inishmore off the west coast of Ireland where The Banshees of Inisherin was filmed. Yeah, we wanted to see the landmarks and the vistas we had just visited. We wanted to see those on the big screen or the little screen on the airplane seat, right? But we had this fortuitous gift in the people that we engaged, the residents on Inishmore, because they unfolded for us and gave us this sense of the ways that Ireland's civil war still weighs on the soul of that nation even today, a century later. And this movie only makes sense as a parable set against the backdrop of Ireland's civil war. So, just very briefly, in the 1920s, Irish friends and family members turned on one another in a bloody fight over whether one supported the peace treaty with Britain or not. One day, brothers, family members were drinking their pints in pubs together. The next day, they were killing one another only and all because the political powers that be convinced them literally overnight that those who stood on the other side of the contrived line of treaty allegiance were now worth killing. Now, I want to be clear. The treaty with Britain and all that has flowed from it in Ireland's and Northern Ireland's troubled history since is complicated. But Porrig and Calm in the film and their tragic strife are commentary on how we can so easily justify violence, drawing lines of otherness that lose sight of our common humanity. And folks, I belabor all of this because I fear this is what our nation is doing right here and right now. We are using tribal affiliations that are derived from a political and social landscape so hyperpolarized that we are teetering on the fulcrum of a civil war, a wholly unnecessary and tragically violent civil war if we do not find another way. Now, if that all seems too hyperbolic in rhetoric to you, then choose another tack if you wish. Only beware of the rhetoric of otherness. It is fuel for the fire of violence, and it slices both ways indiscriminately. It may appear on the surface that Jesus is saying in this passage this morning, don't get too attached to your family members, for some of them will turn on you if you follow me, if you follow the ways of Jesus. And at one level, yeah, perhaps that's true. But a deeper probing might suggest a more nuanced message. It's very interesting, very curious, that when Jesus says at the end of the passage, whoever loves father or mother more than me, or whoever loves son or daughter more than me, the Greek word used here for love is not agape, godly love, it's phileo. And Matthew only uses phileo in those two phrases there and three other times in the whole of the gospel, all in pejorative and admonishing ways. He says, do not be like the hypocrite who loves phileo to pray in public, putting on airs. He says, do not be like the one who loves to sit in the best seat at the feast rather than going to the lowest seat and being invited forward. And then thirdly, most tragic and disturbing of all, when Judas in the Garden of Gethsemane tells the guards that the one he will kiss, literally the one he loves, phileo, is the one to be arrested. Each of these words using the word phileo bears some status seeking, some self-importance, some ego need dependent on the other's attention back to us, or what C.S. Lewis calls need love. It is self-serving, it is consumptive, it is inevitably destructive. And Jesus is saying, don't do that. And lest we think that this is about finger pointing, we all have it within us to nourish this sort of consumptive need love. And Jesus comes with a sword, not of violence, but a sword as a severing tool to cut the cords of the false self's need love, the one that wants the attention back, in order to be released to be into the freedom of following Christ, where losing one's life is the path to finding it. So the invitation for you and me here this morning is to look across the landscape of our lives and see where we have perhaps set up family or any of the good things of life within a paradigm of phileo or need love or a hyper-emphasized sense of importance that then blinds us to the sort of love that God has for us and yearns for us to have for one another. It is a liberating and life-giving love, freely given, unconstrained, and unconstraining. The truth is, friends, God has this sort of love for every human being and expects us to as well, even when we disagree. A profligate love that is antidote for our predisposition toward the politics of divisive othering. It won't inoculate us against another's turn to violence, but we have a choice in how we respond. And folks, Jesus doesn't let us off easy. This is the harder way, the harder road to be sure. But I am convinced that this world, this nation, this community, every one of us need this message of real love, true love, now as much as ever. And it is our story to tell as followers of Christ. It's our story to live if we're willing. The final scene of the film, The Banshees of Inisherin, has the two embittered friends, now turned enemies, Porrig and Colm, on the beach at sunrise. And they refuse to release their enmity against one another, but they cannot help themselves from each offering a tender gesture of the concern for the other's well-being. And in that moment, there is, I think, a simultaneous sense of tragedy and hope, which seems a fitting, if wholly unsatisfactory, ending to the parable, inviting us to pick it up and make it our own. Tragedy, but with hope. So what will we do from here?